Good morning, or good afternoon. Wow, it's been a long day. It's morning still. Thank you for coming to this forum on the financial situation, financial crisis, financial panic, whatever it is you'd like to call it. And we might even get a definition of terms today during our first talk. Working from the far left and back toward me, Professor Howard Bonin. He is from the Department of Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate. Next to him, Dr. William Hudson, also from the Department of Finance, Insurance, and Real Estate. Next to me, Dr. Ming Chen Lo, who is from the Department of Economics. My name's King Banyan. I'm also from the Department of Economics. Before we begin, and we only have an hour, so I'm gonna work very fast here. I want to make sure that you know that this talk has been brought to you through the graces of the Student Economics Association. There's several members of the SEA here in the audience. We thank you for sponsoring us today. We thank you all for being here. This is a very exciting, interesting time. As I often say, at the beginning of every class, an econ professor says, this is an exciting time to study economics, and the reaction from the students in the room is, yeah, right. Well, guess what? Here's the one time where it actually is an exciting time to be an economist or a professor of finance. We're going to work along. I think the order we've agreed is to work basically from left to right.
Whatever you want to do.
Okay, so we're going to work first with some discussion first from Professor Bonin, and then we'll move, in this direction, Professor Hudson, then Professor Lowe, and then myself. Last, we'll take about 10 minutes each. We want to have time for about 20 minutes of discussion. If you have friends that wanted to hear this but couldn't make it, we anticipate that this is going to be podcast at KVSC. We want to thank Jim and the folks at KVSC for agreeing to podcast this event. Thank you very much. And with that, let me get started right away and introduce to you Professor Howard Bonin.
Good afternoon. I'm a notes guy. I'm not a PowerPoint guy, so I'll have to be looking down here once in a while. Mark Twain said that one of the worst months to invest in the stock market was October. And the other bad ones are January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, November, and December. And it is October, and we're seeing some bad market. I'm basically doing the effect of the market crisis, of the financial crisis, because we've certainly seen some shakeout in the markets. I'd like to start with some terminology. A market reversal. A market reversal is a sudden change in price, and usually that's a downward change. We don't worry about the sudden upward changes, do we? A market correction. Does anybody know what a market correction is? A market correction is a drop in price of 10% from a previous high. A bear market. Anybody want to try that one? Paul? 20%. A bear market is a drop in price of at least 20% from a previous high over a prolonged period. This usually takes more than 2 months. A market crash. What do you think a market crash is? I couldn't find a good definition. 40%? Well, then we're in a crash, aren't we? The closest I could come was a very rapid drop of 20%. And one source said in 1 day. Well, by that standard, we've only had one market crash in history. And that was October 19th, 1987. So I expanded the definition a little bit and said if we have a major decline of over 20% in a short period of time, and I've expanded that to at least a couple weeks, we have a crash, and we have had a crash, ladies and gentlemen. A couple other terminologies. A cyclical low is a market low in a cycle. Market goes up, market goes down. A cyclical low is where we're on the bottom of that upswing. And a secular low is defined as a once-in-a-generation market low. And if you can get in a secular low, that launches a long-term bull market. What's a bull market? Pretty much the opposite of a bear. That's when everything's going good. If you can get in at a secular low, you're doing pretty well for yourself. Have we seen either a cyclical or secular low? I do not think so. As a matter of fact, we have to watch out for the famous dead cat bounce. Who knows what a dead cat bounce is? Caitlin? Has one happened lately? When? Friday we had a dead cat bounce. The stock market was up 936 points. Monday was the stock market was up 936 points. Yesterday it was down 77 again, and when I checked at 1 o'clock this afternoon, the market itself was down 550 points once again. All-time highs, Dow Jones Industrial Average, 14,165 roughly on the 9th of October last year. The Standard & Poor's 500, 1,565 on the 9th of October last year, almost exactly 1 year ago. NASDAQ hit its high on the 10th of October, there's Mark Twain again, in 2000 at 5,132. As of 1 o'clock this afternoon, from their all-time highs, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 38%, the S&P 500 is down 40%, and NASDAQ is down 67%. During the last year, we have lost $8 trillion in stock market wealth in our country. We were at $20 trillion, we've fallen to $12 trillion. You might ask yourself, does a fall of 40% of our nation's stock market wealth bode well or ill for our economy? And we'll be hearing from some of our other speakers shortly. Great market crashes we have known. In the year 1929, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went from about 381 to 41, an overall drop of 89%. That great crash lasted for 12 years until 1941. In the 1970s, the Dow Jones Industrial Average went from just under 1,000 to 800 after 15 years, meaning ignoring dividends, you could be invested for 15 years and still have lost 20% of your money. In 1987, we had the largest single point drop on a given day, 508 points on the 19th, 22.6%. You could have lost almost a fourth of your money in one day in the stock market. That crash lasted 5 months. In the year 2000, the NASDAQ reached its high of 5,132.52, and by the year 2002, it lost 78.4% of its value. We could probably make the argument that the 2000 crash is still with us. Since the high in 2000, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 23%, which means after 8 years, if you'd been solidly investing, once again ignoring dividends, you're down almost a quarter of your money. I've got a lot of reasons as to why these things happen. I'm going to skip over that and go to two final things. The first one is, what should you do? What should you do? Are things going to get better in the near term? Are we in a cyclical market cycle? Are we in a secular cycle? Are we at the low? What's the conventional wisdom? Anybody? Paul, what do they say? Stay the course. The conventional wisdom is, don't try and time the market, keep doing what you're doing. If you're a young person, and I see a lot of young people in the room, if you're just going to be graduating, if you're going to get a job, if you're going to start investing in the marketplace through your 401ks, my advice is get in and go. Don't worry about timing the market. Don't worry about the bottom. Get in and go, be aggressive, look to the long run. Most of the bloodshed is over. If you're some of us old-timers, old-time investors, the ship has sailed. Most of the bloodshed is probably over. You've lost a fortune, Is it time to panic and escape the stock market now? I don't think so. I'd argue we're probably not at the bottom, but it's certainly not time to panic and run. I do have some other statistics for you. If you are in the stock market for 1 year, based on historical evidence, this comes from a group called Ibbotson and Associates, the probability of losing money is about 27%. In 1 year, any year, you could lose money in real terms about 1 out of 4 times. If you're in the stock market for 5 years, the probability of losing money in real terms falls to 10%. If you're in the stock market for 10 years, the probability of being worse off after 10 years is only 3%. And if you can be in the stock market for at least 16 years, based on historical evidence, how many times, what percentage of the time have you been worse off? 0%. And so I think I'm running a little bit short on time. I'll pass it off to our next speaker.
I want to talk a little bit about how we kind of got to this point, the credit crisis. Anybody have a home mortgage in here? Okay. And when you make your payment every month, do you make it to the place that loaned you the money? Or does it go somewhere else? Sometimes it goes somewhere else. I can almost guarantee you the bank that made you the loan does not hold the mortgage. 80% or better of home mortgages these days are sold off in something called a mortgage-backed security, and they are broken into little pieces and sold off as different investments. And you can buy whatever piece of a batch of mortgages that you want. Okay? So, now the insurance industry is highly, highly regulated. Wouldn't you agree that insurance companies are required to keep reserves against potential losses? And that's important because we don't want to be driving around in our cars, crashing our car, and all of a sudden we find out our insurance company can't pay. Okay, so what are we going to do? We're going to buy insurance. But we're not going to call it insurance. We're going to call it a credit default swap. In effect, it's insurance, but because we don't call it insurance, all of a sudden now it's not regulated. Okay, companies don't have to keep reserves against this. And so some of the companies that sold a lot of these credit default swaps, you might recognize some of the names, Bear Stearns, AIG, Lehman Brothers, all have something in common at the moment, if you remember what's happening. Basically, to my derivative students, they were selling put options, weren't they? But not required to keep reserves in case they lost. Okay, so what were we doing? We are selling insurance that these loans are going to pay off. And as such, what happens is all of a sudden, if you have these credit default swaps covering these loans, all of a sudden you can get the rating agency, Standard & Poor's and Moody's, to give the best piece of these mortgages a AAA rating, which is the best you can get. Investment grade. Sounds good, right? Except that the insurance on these mortgages was not worth a whole lot. Now, it's really fun to write or solve credit default swaps in a housing market that is going this direction, isn't it? I simply collect my premiums and nothing happens as far as defaults. And all of a sudden, the defaults kick in and we have a problem. Okay, so the first one to go down was Bear Stearns. Then came Lehman Brothers. They let that one fail. AIG had too many credit default swaps out there. That was the too big to fail doctrine. They weren't going to let that one go under. A lot of people argue that Lehman Brothers shouldn't have been allowed to go under either. Okay, now let's come back full circle to our credit crisis. Banks, for lack of a better word, just had a bomb go off. Banks don't know what other banks are sitting on as far as these mortgage-backed securities, which ones are paying, which ones aren't, because they are broken into so many different pieces. As such, you see banks not trusting each other. And how is that manifested? When a bank doesn't trust another bank, they're reluctant to lend with one another. Okay, therefore, you see something called LIBOR, which stands for London Interbank Offered Rate, spiking to record levels, 6%, in a 6% range. Okay, unheard of, unheard of. Banks don't trust each other. They don't know what they don't know what they have in their portfolio. So who is at fault? I'll do my editorializing. I think a number of entities are at fault. I think the entities that made the loans to begin with, what's their incentive? Make the loan, collect my fees, commission, and sell it off. I don't have to live with the results. Okay. Also, I think the rating agencies bear some responsibility for assigning these AAA ratings based on credit default swaps, which in many cases were not backed. And also the companies that sold credit default swaps, great way to make fee, you know, make income and generate fees. Hope you never have to pay off on them. So that's where we're at. Banks don't trust each other, and away we go.
I think my talk would be a little bit more fragmented. And particularly, I want to maybe highlight some of the factors that the two speakers did not mention. I think one of the things in my talk I would really try to avoid is to be, a Monday morning quarterback. I think, you know, of course, you know, in hindsight, we know all this problem. And then if we go back 7 or 8 years ago, you know, if we were in that position, would we be able to foresee that 8 years later there is such a problem? And I want to make an analogy and, you know, think about where we are. This is, think about earthquake. If you choose to live in California, you know that, you know, there will be a big earthquake, all right? But you can drink very good wine, the sun is, you know, very nice, a lot of sunshine. Or you can choose to live in Minnesota, and, it's a little bit colder. Sometimes there's tornadoes, but you know there won't be, you know, catastrophic, natural disaster. Now, but there is a third possibility, and maybe we were in the third possibility. A few years ago, when I listened to maybe NPR or National Geographic, some geologists actually said besides California, besides the West Coast, one of the major earthquake zones is actually in the center of America. That would be like Missouri and Tennessee. But what's the problem is that people do not aware about that. And, you know, they did not buy insurance, and the constructions of the building, you know, were not prepared for the earthquake. So, you know, so we may be, in Tennessee or Missouri, okay, in that regard. And also, you know, the more I learn about this current financial crisis, people make analogy like this is very similar to the Great Depression. And the more I look at it, you know, it's more like World War One. World War One all of a sudden, you know, broke out, and people did not, you know, realize, you know, what's going on. And even after all this year, historians still debate, you know, what's the cause of World War One. So here's, you know, a list of, you know, things that I think, you know, they contribute, you know, to the crisis. And as a matter of fact, you know, maybe if we don't have one of that, we don't see, such a big negative effect. Now, when we talk about, crisis, Wall Street, of course, right away, the image we think about is Michael Douglas. Okay, greed is good. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, recently he was in, he was trying to sell one of his films, and people asked him about what's going on in the Wall Street. And he said, I was just a fictional character, all right? And indeed, I think it was mentioned that, you know, some of the initiations of the loans was bad. And it is indeed, you know, driven by, you know, greed intentions. And I also agree that, you know, that the regular model of trading, okay, they failed, okay? So when we talk about all this CDS, the credit default swap, and all this financial instrument. However, in this regard, I wonder, you know, should we imagine a Michael Douglas, you know, trying to get as much money as possible, or it is a matter that on one hand, they are risk loving. On the other hand, it is, you know, the model that they have been using are mistaken. I don't have the answer, but, you know, some of you may have read or heard about the book Black Swan. So they talk about, you know, the general idea that, you know, we try to use statistics to models, okay? And I think, you know, that, you know, in the last, you know, all these years, a lot of the banks, they thought, I'm just doing business as usual. I have did a lot of good trading practice and good models. But what they may be doing is they are, you know, following the practice that, you know, that cannot handle the black swan. And the author of the book basically suggests that, you know, there are a lot of shock that, you know, you just cannot model. All right. So these two are, you know, the factors that I think, you know, people have been talking about, you know, the banks and the banker. But also I want to mention that, you know, there are other factors that, you know, may drive what we see today. One is that it turns out that maybe, you know, there are good intentions that has bad consequence. All right. Why do we have a subprime market in the first place? So nowadays, you know, people, you know, said, oh, you know, these are the people that they should not have given a mortgage. So if we roll back, you know, 8 years or even, you know, like 20 years before, as far as I know, even before the current administrations, there are a lot of push from the government for the subprime market. And why is that? Well, if you go back, what is the rhetoric? Well, a lot of the people who cannot get the prime rate, they are people who does not have the privilege. They are underprivileged. These are people that we need to help them. So they cannot get the loan, and therefore they cannot get the house. So therefore, the advocacies of the subprime market, what actually started, you know, before 2000. Okay, so I think, you know, this is a very good example that, you know, there were good intention, but because the good intentions was not, you know, delivered with care, and it leads to some troubles later on. Finally, I want to mention one thing is the Federal Reserve. Okay, and one of the reason why between year 2000 and 2004, from the numbers that I read, you know, the home ownership jumped roughly about from 62% to 69%. And again, you know, this is based on the philosophy that, you know, it's better to own than rent. Okay. And during that period, one of the Federal Reserve actions is to lower interest rates. And the reason for that is, you know, we have a recession in 2000 and 2001. You know, the regular model says lower the interest rate, stimulate the market. All right. So together with all of the aforementioned factor, that creates, you know, a very sharp increasing housing prices. Okay. And because of that, you know, people don't worry too much about default. You know, even if this mortgage loan default, you know, the bank still has the house and the price is really good, all right? And the thing is, about year 2005 or so, you know that one thing that worry us is inflation, all right? And again, the traditional monetary theory suggests that when there's a high inflation, the central bank has to increase interest rate to slow down the economy. And so this is, you know, kind of expected. And what is also interesting is that, you know, from 2002, when the Federal Reserve is lowering the interest rate, and then until 2005, 2007, and 2006, when they raised the interest rate, the housing market was not a variable to be considered. And one thing that is also very interesting is, as a matter of fact, Benjamin Bernanke, he was a speaker before he became the chairman. He was a speaker at the Winter Institute in 2003, so he came to campus. And so this is you know, a quote from what he said from the Federal Reserve web page. So say, why has mortgage debt risen by so much in the past decade? So he's not only talking about, you know, a few years before 2003, he's talking about from 1993. Well, one very positive factor is the secular increase in U.S. home ownership rates. Because of rising incomes, increased rates of family formation, and the expansion of so-called subprime mortgage lending, more people have chosen to buy homes rather than to rent, increasing the values of mortgage outstanding. Okay, so we are talking about one of the best monetary theorists, and in that time, just like a lot of other peoples, the rhetoric that it's better to own a home than to rent was, you know, really indeed strong. And therefore, the housing market was never a variable, okay, in the Federal Reserve decisions. So when the Federal Reserve decided to fight inflation because of the crude oil, people worry about much more about crude oil in 2005 than the housing market. People worry much more about the food prices than the housing market. So during that time, Bernanke, led Federal Reserve decided that we have to raise interest rate. And that is about the time a lot of the interest rate become adjustable, right? Because you have all this different loan. So so anyway, I think, you know, there are a lot of, factors that are working. But by the end of the day, I think, you know, in a crisis, there are also some, entities that, make smart decisions. Wells Fargo is not in crisis. Wells Fargo is buying stuff. Warren Buffett is, buying a lot of, assets at a cheaper price too. But one thing that really struck me is if you look at the global economy, Asian banks are not really in crisis. And why is that? Well, because Asia has been in crisis in the 80s, like Japan, in the 90s, like the East Asian countries. So these institutions actually got the experience, and actually after their crisis, the government improved the transparency, and they also oversees the operations much tighter than it was. So therefore, I think there are a lot of things that we can learn from the experience with the Asian crisis, especially the Asian crisis, very similar to here. Started with the collapse of the housing market in Thailand. All right. Now, finally, I just want to show two graphs. Show you a little bit distinctions. I think currently, unlike the Asian crisis, when the crisis happened, people move away. Move the money away from the country. So it is a vote against, the economy. But if you look at some numbers, very interestingly, it is not a vote, the market did not vote against America as a whole. It is just that they vote against, the banking system. So this is the Treasury bills rate. And you can see that this is the interest rate that is negatively correlated with the price of the Treasury bills. So you can see that it really, dropped a lot towards zero. And this is caused by the market moving the money to Treasury bills because they feel it is really safe. What about the global economy? Well, this is the exchange rate. Now, notice that because of the way we index the exchange rate, when the exchange rate increases, it is an appreciation of euro and a depreciation of the U.S. And if you look at, in the second half of 2008, you can see the exchange rate is going down. This refers to a depreciation of euro and an appreciation of U.S. dollars. So this is, kind of a little bit counterintuitive. When the United States is, in a financial crisis, where did the money go? Well, the money goes to the Fed, the Treasury bills, the government Treasury bills, and U.S. dollars.
My job was to play cleanup hitter, which, given how the Red Sox did last night, is pretty tough for me to do. But I wanted to try to fill in some things. My job is basically to try to fill some blanks here. And if I just run through my slides real quickly, it's largely because, as I had thought might happen, the previous three speakers have covered a number of the pieces that I thought were worth looking at. Let me respond first to some of the things that Bill said in his presentation. What did a mortgage look like? In the old days, it just looked like a transaction between a bank and someone living in a house. Okay, that nice story that George Bailey tells in the middle of It's a Wonderful Life. Okay, of where, you know, no, your money's not in the bank, your money's in Jim's house, and no, your money's not here, it's in Jane's business, and so on. Now look at how houses get packaged together through an originator, an arranger, lots of different pools of mortgage-backed securities going on here. It's a very complicated world we live in. I don't know that I would call that a bad thing. You might think that was a mistake. My view of it is that throughout history, if you take a long view of the world, we have advanced as societies because of our ability to manage risk, among other things. It's not the only thing that helped us in advance, but the ability to manage and move around risk has been one of the major things which has led to human advancement, going all the way back to insuring the ships that traveled around the oceans in the 15th, 16th, and 17th century. Who was going to do that? How is that to happen? So we have lots of financial innovation, but that financial innovation from time leads to excess. And as we go through and look at this particular episode in human history, okay, Professor Bonin spent some time talking about 1929. If I was looking for a parallel today, I would actually go back further. I would actually go back to look at something like the Panic of 1907. As an example of a pure banking crisis that broke out in New York City. But my point being, this isn't new. This is what happens in dynamic economies. To go to something else that Professor Hudson said, here's a picture of all the different types of adjustable of mortgages that are out there, which are going that are adjustable in one way or another, and then are going to reset their price. That size, those bars represent how soon it will be that that mortgage will first reset. We've got the ones that have already happened in 2007 through here, but you can see there's another wave, a big wave of them coming through something that's called an option arm, okay, which means paying the principal and even part of your interest is optional. Yeah, I know. A guy up here just frowned at me, and he's right. It seems like a weird thing to do, but if you thought your house was always going to go up in price, if you got caught up in the mania that happened in the housing market over the last 6-7 years, you might think to yourself, why should I wait to get my money out of the house? I can take it out now by paying less on my house and using some of that money to buy a car or to take a trip or to help my kids' education or so forth. Okay, there's a whole big wave of that. Of those types of repricings of those mortgages that are coming in another year or two. So for those folks who want to say, well, this is an episode and we'll be done with it soon, I say not so fast, my friend. I'd also look at what's going on in the real economy. People, one of the things we haven't talked about yet today, and I'll do this quickly, is whether or not we're in a recession. I think the answer now has to be yes. Okay, don't ask me when it started. I'm going to say sometime this summer. I'm not sure. If you actually made me say a month, I would guess July, because that's about the time that those tax stimulus checks stopped coming into us. I think that's a fairly good guess. But you know, don't make me bet money on it, because I'm not sure where the date will be set eventually. But this is a weekly index from Economic Cycle Research. This is Economic Cycle Research Institute out of New York. They do a weekly leading index, and the last data point I have is for October 3. You can see that it's accelerated really over the last 6, 7, 8 weeks. and that if we were not in a severe recession before, I don't think there's much doubt that we are now. One of the things we haven't yet talked about is one of the pieces of financing which banks have had trouble with. We talked about the credit default swaps, but we should also spend a lot of time looking at the commercial paper market. It is a market that is used very short term, supposed to be very safe. It's a way in which banks are supposed to be able to lend money to each other and between banks and more. This is and non-financials. Non-financial firms have experienced no change in their availability of commercial paper. All of it has happened between the banks. So as Professor Hudson said before, the banks don't trust each other. They don't trust each other. Another example of that, this is a graph that I've drawn using a Bloomberg chart. The gold line is the 3-month Treasury bill rate. Blue line is the LIBOR rate. That's the rate at which banks lend to each other internationally, particularly in Europe. And then the overnight index swap, which is another representation of the rate at which banks are going to trade with each other. And if you do that comparison, when the Federal Reserve is trying to figure out how tight the money market is, these are the data that they're looking at. This is a chart that I know from talking to people at the Fed that they are studying right now. And the size of this spread is typically, this is sort of a normal spread. You can see now that in the spread between these two, they typically travel very much close together. They diverge in the middle of September, just about the time Lehman's allowed to fail. And you can now see that the spread is huge. That is a representation of the credit crunch, okay? And when people would talk to me about why do we need the bailout bill, if I could get them to understand this graph, I think I was able to tell them, in fact, why we needed to do something. I don't know that I liked the bill. I don't know, in fact, that, I mean, I'm not even sure anymore that the bill I thought they passed 2 weeks ago is the bill they're enacting now. All right? It seems like the target's moved on us. But to some extent, it's true. And then what Professor Lowe said, talking about the flight to quality, the flight to the U.S. dollar, that's represented here in terms of the difference between the LIBOR rate and the 3-month Treasury rate. People are sending their money into the United States, which is really counterintuitive. If we were in really bad shape, if we were heading into a depression, wouldn't the money flow someplace else? So far, it hasn't. The one bright spot for you, and I know this is supposed to be on finance, and this is not, but I'm going to use this to illustrate the point I'm trying to make, that we are, in fact, in the real economy heading into a recession. These are the prices on the left for crude oil, on the right for the spot price for unleaded gas for delivery at the harbor in New York City. You can see the sharp drop in them, again, starting in July, accelerating after the Lehman bankruptcy, and heading sharply down. I drew this one actually late last weekend. Using last Friday's price. I know it's come off even further since then. You may think that's wonderful, and maybe the oil companies are de-gouging. Okay, if they were gouging when the price was going up, I don't know what you call it when it's going down. I think de-gouging might be a word. But I think in fact what that graph really represents is that the demand for commodities is dropping around the world. Not just oil. I could give you 20 more of these graphs for zinc, aluminum, any kind of building product whatsoever. And it's an indication that around the world, economies are slowing down. This is not just a U.S. issue. This is a world issue. In the interest of making this a forum where other people could speak, I will shut up now. As you ask the question, if I walk toward you, it's because I'm having trouble hearing you, and I will repeat the question. And please tell us who you'd like the question to go to. I think she's talking about something that Paul Krugman wrote over the last couple of days. I don't know if any of you have seen it or not yet. The question was Paul Krugman had said that in fact a crash in the stock market has nothing to do with the real economy. Do you guys agree with that or not?
Well, he's got a Nobel Prize and I don't.
Same here.
Yeah. But the stock market hopefully leads the economy. Investors don't stand in the middle of the road with like deer in the headlights hoping to get hit. Investors move in advance of what they think is going to happen. So The stock market roughly correlates with the strength of the real economy and hopefully leads it a little bit.
Do you want to add anything to that?
This is my personal opinion. I think what we're seeing right now is the market is obviously jittery and just unsure. The world governments are coming in to try and prop up the situation. So one day you'll see positive reaction to that, and then the next day, you know, jobless claims come out or something like that, and it's just going like this. It doesn't know which to follow.
Did you want to? Or
well, no? I would try to interpret what Krugman said is a lot of the things we see in the financial market and the money market is nominal. We define real things like the food we eat. But when we put a price as a value to real items like food, like clothing, we are talking about the nominal value. And I think what he says means is that a lot of this was really driven by expectation gone wild. It's just like people are in a stage that the financial market is in a stage of frenzy that people are not thinking about. Are we less productive? Are we more productive? Not thinking about the real productivity, but rather, it's more about a stage of, psychological panic. I think that may be how I would interpret him. And also, I want to just very quickly, if I can show a diagram.
Sure.
The last recessions in 2001 is very different from the previous recessions. In the sense that traditionally recession is defined as real GDP decline by two quarters or more. The 2001 recessions is already different in the sense that it goes down, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. So that one, economists already think that the traditional definition doesn't work. And also right now, this time, I think it's one thing that is interesting is that the blue line is the growth rate of the GDP. And right now we are still positive. Okay, well, this is up to the second quarter of this year. All right, but if you look at unemployment rate, it's already pretty much reaching the peak after last recession. So if we define recessions by unemployment, then we are already not doing very well. So maybe the definition needs to be changed. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. I'm gonna go ahead and ask your question,
okay.
Please. And you're next door. Dr. Lowe, that's your expertise.
Well, I did not look at Japanese yen, but if U.S. Appreciate against euro, and Japanese yen appreciate against U.S. dollars, then it means if we are having a three horse race, then Japan is getting the gold medal. And part of it again, I think, is that if you look around the bad news, Iceland went bankrupt, okay. But we have not heard much bad news in Asia, so I think that may I don't know if you have an answer, but I think it may although still the U.S. economy still is the largest economy in the world, it will still have a negative spillover effect. But in terms of the vote of confidence, it may be a good time to buy Japanese stock. Part of it is if you look at the bias, Japanese banks has been quite aggressively buying cheap in Europe right now. Yeah. So
I'm going to ask you up here, and I'll get to you next. Okay.
Well, as a psychologist in the crew, I guess my interest is in how people feel, and my question is, what is the hypothesized relationship between the bailout and the restoration of public trust, and how do you see that actually playing out at this time? I mean, I keep hearing, you just have to wait till things really take effect, but I really would like to know, what is the hypothesized relationship, and how do you, any of you, see that actually playing out now?
I'd be willing to take a shot at that. The bailout bill was originally presented us with the idea that there was a liquidity crisis, okay, and that the Federal Reserve has spent over the last year roughly $500 billion out of its portfolio, basically trading good Treasury securities for other securities of dubious quality, okay, to put it politely. Some of it really bad stuff. Some of it probably stuff that will be valuable at some point, but just wasn't right now. Okay, so that's what we were told we needed, was they needed $700 billion. In essence, the Federal Reserve had run out of bullets, and they needed to reload. Okay, over this past weekend with the meeting of the G7 finance ministers, we basically have turned on a dime and started to go toward the other problem, which is the banks simply need to be recapitalized. Okay, the balance sheets of the banks are what the issue is, as both Professors Bonin and Hudson were saying, it's, the reason we don't trust the banks is because if the banks actually have to recognize the losses on those securities that are on the asset side of their balance sheet, they're going to end up bust. Okay, so someone needs to step in and make them not go bust. And be nice if Warren Buffett would do it, but he has only so much money. You know, and the size of this problem is even too big for Warren Buffett. So that ends up being something that which government needs to do. And I think actually, although you might want to argue, if I might disagree with Professor Bonin just a bit, it could be. I apologize, sir. But it might be a dead cat bounce, but it might be a recognition that they finally know what the $700 billion is going towards, which I think honestly, from the weekend after they passed the bill until Monday, I did not know really. I was no longer confident what they're going to spend the money on. Originally it's going to be for liquidity. We're going to buy mortgage-backed securities. And then McCain says, oh no, we're going to buy houses with it. And then Obama has a plan for this, and the Bush administration just natters on. And I'm not sure there's been any real serious ability to recognize what it is they're saying. And so I think in the end we ended up in a situation where there was a lot of uncertainty. I think uncertainty is what killed the market last week. That uncertainty cost us 17% in a 1 week loss. Okay, and most of that $8 trillion that we're talking about. Okay, I do think that now that we know where that money is going, and they've said $25 billion goes here, $25 billion goes there. At least now we can move on. Okay. We know what's happening, and what really kills a market more than anything, and I think we'll all agree with that, is the uncertainty. Go ahead. You know what? I'm going to recognize the person in the back first, and then our good guest second here. Question is: should the bailout buy shares of stock, or should they be buying? They should be buying bad debt. What do you guys have any opinion on that?
We had a similar situation in the 30s. They created an outfit called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And essentially it did the same thing. It bought stock in banks and after a while was supposed to get out of the business. From the Reconstruction Finance Corporation in 1932 came the Commodity Credit Corporation, the Small Business Administration, and a little outfit called Fannie Mae, which you may have heard about. The bad news of the government getting into this stuff is we don't know how long they're going to be there. Mm-hmm. The good news is they're buying non-voting preferred stock. It would be catastrophic otherwise. In other words, the government's not going to try and run these businesses, and that's the good news.
Good point.
Even when they're buying up the bad debt, aren't they getting warrants for equity?
The original plan was that they would buy bad debt and get warrants, basically an option to buy stock. But that the banks could then buy back away from them by repaying the loan.
Well, talking about psychology, I don't know whether it is more a gesture, whether to just buy the asset or buy the stock. But one thing I do remember during the Asian crisis, George Soros and the speculator, they did a dual attack. They attacked the Hong Kong currency. Which is pegged with U.S. dollars, and then at the same time, they expect Hong Kong government would raise interest rates so that they short the stock in Hong Kong. And what happened is, as much as free market reputations you may heard of Hong Kong, the government all of a sudden purchased 10% of the stock of some of the major, Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. Okay. So everyone say, like, you know, what's going on? You are a free market, you know, economy. And all of a sudden you, you know, make such a big gesture. Well, supposedly George Soros lost a lot of money in that run. And right after, you know, the Hong Kong government just very auctioned the stock very quickly. So so I don't know how relevant it is. It's not exactly, you know, parallel, but I think it was a big gesture.
I'm glad that's your question.
Thank you. Thank you, Teresa.
Talk about loaded guns.
There are those out there that actually are blaming the Greenspan regime for a lot of cheap money out there sloshing around. I really think it's all three. And one thing I did want to mention about credit default swaps, in other words, they are selling insurance, but default swap insurance is different than homeowners insurance. And this is something I failed to mention earlier. If my house burns down, it doesn't mean increase the probability of your house burning down. But if one batch of mortgages defaults, foreclosures, pushing homes onto the market, depressing prices, can cause other loans or mortgages to default as well. And so I think what you saw was a cascading effect. So these people, Bear Stearns, AIG, Lehman Brothers, were selling insurance to cover assets whose defaults, you've heard the word systematic risk, were linked in a way. I don't know if that answered your question or not.
Go ahead, please.
Well, I just wanted to talk about this this morning. It just seems like there's no fundamentals in the market right now. It just seems like, you know, when they had like the rate cut and they have the, you know, bailout plan got passed, it's like there's no fundamentals, and then they go on the short selling ban. It's like, is that normal when you enter a recession? It just seems like so crazy that nothing's following what it should, and it's like managing a fund is, it's so frustrating and difficult.
I think what you're seeing, you know, they always say this time is different than past times. I think this time is different because I think what you've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is a proliferation of something called financial engineering, where you've got all these quants on Wall Street, these PhDs in mathematics and physics that could dream up all these exotic instruments like mortgage-backed securities, default swaps. And I think there's a lot of people don't even understand how to value these things, like these mortgage-backed securities on these banks. And a lot of these derivatives are traded over the counter. So there's
Could you
not
describe
a,
that in case some people okay, here don't
sir.
Understand that?
Two types of market. Organized exchange, for example, the New York Stock Exchange, continuous auction market, prices updated second by second. Okay. Over the counter market, just informal contact between dealers, not necessarily continuously traded, sometimes not traded at all for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to have one more student. It's going to have to be the last question because we're right up on 3 o'clock. So mortgage-backed securities, the difficulty of finding a price, of finding any price.
Well, one of the arguments for buying up these mortgage-backed securities is the government, and I'm not sure how they are going to do it, is we will buy them at X price, and that was going to then somehow provide some kind of a floor for valuation of these securities.
And they can do that. In fact, last Friday there was a meeting of all the holders of the credit default swaps that Lehman had, and they auctioned off a huge package of them. They netted about $400 billion out, meaning mm-hmm. they were able to make $400 billion of it disappear, and then they sold the rest of it off and found a floor. Now, the floor turns out to be a pretty dang low price, 9 cents on the dollar. Okay, that doesn't sound, less than a dime. On the other hand, at least you went out and found a private price. In essence, what the government was going to do was say, we're going to create a price for you somehow. The danger, and I'm going to close on this thought, but it was something that Professor Hudson and I had talked about while I think Professor Bono was answering a question. I think the risk in this all is that somehow we're receiving the socialization of risk, the possibility of moral hazard creeping up. That banks are in essence being told, if you take too many risks, that's okay, we'll take care of you. All right, well, you'll be fine. And that is certainly a major problem that I see with any kind of bailout plan. But most of the financial markets we have depend on there being a price available. And what had happened in the middle of this crisis, in my mind, was you simply had a market in which no one would even tell you a price at all. So there ceased to be communication between buyers and sellers. In that situation, I can imagine that being called a market failure that perhaps can have a role for government to play. So I'm, as someone who is a great supporter of free markets, I do see a case to be made that in fact in that particular environment, government might have had a beneficial effect on what was going on in financial markets, but for a very limited time. And I think to emphasize a point that both these gentlemen made, the question is the exit strategy. When does government get back out? So having them being non-voting preferred shares of stock is a vital, great sign. That, by the way, is not just in the U.S. I believe that's also the terms in the European market as well. And with that, we could obviously go for another hour, but I think this room's promised to somebody else. Thank you very much. And would you join me in giving a hand to our guests here? Thank you very much. Have a good day.